Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Taking a look at the stars and the planets today. We're getting a winter update for you stargazers out there. And even if you're not a regular stargazer, planet watcher, I think there's less to see out there right now in the sky. And Paul Kinzer's along to talk with us about it. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. He's a member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club and often stops by to talk about the latest in news in astronomy and what you and I should be looking for in the sky. You can join in. Maybe you have a question. Maybe you've got an experience to share. The number is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And Paul Kinzer, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Great to be to have you here. And, boy, there's so many things we can talk about. It's possible now, technically possible, to see five planets, naked eye planets, at once in the early morning. And that is fairly unique, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it is rare. It's been years since the last time we were able to do that. And right now, from the southeast to the southwestern sky, not too far above the horizon before the sun comes up, say 45 minutes to an hour before it comes up, from left to right, you can see Mercury, Venus, Saturn, Mars, and Jupiter. And those are the five ancient planets. The other planets, Uranus, Neptune, you need a telescope to see those. But the others you can see with the naked eye. And Mercury is going to be a challenge. You need pretty much to know where you're looking, I think, for Mercury. And you need a pretty clear horizon. It won't be very high above the horizon. But the others are much brighter and will be easier to see. Venus is going to be the brightest one. And Saturn and Mars, they are in between Venus and Jupiter, and Jupiter would be the second brightest. Mm-hmm. But Saturn's a little bit yellow, Mars is sort of orange, so they're fairly easy to see. Yeah. if you know where to look. Of course, you need clear skies to see them.
Yeah, which I've been, really eager to see in the last few mornings. I'm up and around at 5:30, so mm-hmm. in the morning, so I have the opportunity, but we've had clouds, so...
That's right. And, of course, as we're moving around the sun and all of the planets are also moving around the sun, their positions are going to change even in the next couple of weeks. Mercury and Venus especially, they go around the sun even more quickly than we do. So it's sort of a dance between all these planets' orbits.
It is really interesting how it moves around. I was in my walk of the last, I don't know how long now, the moon has been on my left shoulder mm-hmm. as I walked along. And then I was sick for a week. And I did not go out at all because I couldn't. And so then the first time I get to go out, suddenly the moon's on my right shoulder.
Right, and the moon, much more than the planets. Of course, the moon goes all the way around the sky, 360 degrees of sky in a month. So at any, from night to night, it's going to move a big chunk across the way. And, of course, it's going to change shape going from new to full back to new again in that month as well.
Yeah, so it was kind of... fun for me it moves pretty fast. Well, how is it that the planets, why does this sort of happen that they
all has to do with their orbits around the sun and where they happen to be in those orbits? And as we look out from our sky here on Earth, we look along a line of sight, and some of these planets you're looking on, they're on the same side of the sun as we are. But others are on the opposite side of the sun in their orbits. This does not mean that the planets are in a line or close to each other in the sky in any way. It just happens that our line of sight and them in their orbits line up.
Yeah.
And it's just temporary.
They look close.
Yeah, they look close, but they are not necessarily close.
How many miles would they be apart?
Well, of these five naked eye planets... The closest ones would be the inner planets, Mercury, Venus, and Mars, and they're tens of millions of miles away. Jupiter is nearly half a billion miles away, and Saturn is about a billion miles away.
Oh, my goodness.
So they are not close together.
They're not close together at all. Paul Kinzer, our guest, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. You may have a question or comment for him. I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on our Facebook page, question and or photo, as a matter of fact, on our Facebook page, and our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Recently, there were a few news stories out about a new planet, significantly bigger than Earth.
That's right. Just really in the last week, we've heard from some one particularly very prominent and well-known astronomer. He and a colleague have released a paper describing what they are convinced is a planet somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 Earth masses, far, far beyond Pluto, very, very far beyond Pluto. Nobody has seen it yet. And the reason they think they haven't seen it yet is it's got a very skewed orbit. Sometimes it comes closer to the sun, but it's still much farther away than Pluto, and they think right now it may be much, much further out. And the reason they believe it's there is because they have spotted with these very large telescopes we now have small bodies out beyond Pluto, and they've studied the orbits of those bodies, and as far as they can tell, the only reason that those bodies would have these very similar orbits is if they had been disturbed by this planet. I heard them talking on the radio just last week. One of them, by the way, his name is, what is it here? I got it. Here we go. Mike Brown. He's the person who discovered the planet Eris. And that discovery of another body out there about the size of Pluto is pretty much what led directly to Pluto being demoted. In fact, he wrote a book about that.
Yeah.
And he is one of the astronomers who's released this paper, and other astronomers I've heard have, looking at their data, said, yeah, this is fairly convincing. And they think it's possible that it will be imaged. Somebody will get a picture of it in the fairly near future, within the next couple of years. And some of the things I heard is maybe one of the reasons we haven't spotted it yet is it may be the direction towards the planet might be right towards the Milky Way. So
okay.
It's lost among the stars.
Oh, sure.
So the planet, they're thinking, is about the same size as Uranus and Neptune, which I believe Neptune has 17 Earth masses, and they're thinking this could be about 10.
About 10. And Caitlin had emailed and wondered if you were going to point in the sky or someplace, where is it supposed to be in the sky right now? Is it the Milky Way? Or?
You know, I actually did read where it was supposed to be, but I am not recalling where. If you do a Google search for Planet 9, which is what they're calling it, which is kind of, there's an old really bad movie called Plan 9 from outer space, and so people are making jokes about that. They did say about where it is or where it could be. They are also saying, though, that even the largest Earth-based telescopes might not be able to image it unless they really expose for quite a long time. So you're not going to see it in a backyard telescope.
And it's not close enough to the sun, is it, close enough to have potential life?
No, I would say no. Neither are Saturn or Jupiter, really, although out there, the moons going around them, the tides created by the gravity of the planets heat up the inside of some of their moons. So they're thinking, well, they're not thinking, they're pretty convinced there are liquid oceans under the surface of those moons. So who knows? You know, even way, way out there, if there's liquid water,
yeah,
who knows?
There could be life inside
mm-hmm. yes.
the planet,
yep.
not out. Paul Kinzer, our guest again, join in at 1-800-642-1234. What's the brightest constellation in the sky right now?
Right now, in fact, at, anytime. The brightest constellation, if you go by how the stars in it and how bright they are, is the constellation Orion. Mm-hmm. It's a very bright winter constellation. Its right foot is a star called Rigel, and its left shoulder is a star called Betelgeuse. And they are two of the brighter stars in the sky. And right now, right when it gets dark, it's rising in the east, and it stays up most of the night. It's a beautiful, beautiful constellation. Just stepping outside and looking at it, and one really, I think, beautiful thing about it is that star Betelgeuse is sort of orange. Hmm. Usually when we look up, we see stars that are white or blue, and you look at this constellation, and up in its left-hand corner, there's a bright orange star. And Orion is an easy constellation to find. It's basically a large rectangle with a stripe, a line of three stars in the middle. It looks sort of like a bow tie or a butterfly.
Yeah, and why? What's responsible for the kind of color that you see? Blue
the stars. Stars. We could talk for an hour about stars and their color. The cooler a star is, the redder it is.
Okay.
And Betelgeuse is a large star, and it's nearing the end of its life. And when stars do that, and the sun will do this as well, although it's not as big as Betelgeuse, so it won't end its life the same way. But Betelgeuse has swollen up as it's used its hydrogen fuel up. Things have changed down below the surface, and it's swollen up. It's quite a large star. In fact, it's so large that if you took the sun out of the solar system and you put Betelgeuse there, we would be inside it.
Oh.
Yeah, that's how big it is. And it's swelling up, and it changes size a little bit. It's not something you could easily detect with the naked eye, but it's going to blow up, unlike the sun. The sun isn't going to blow up. It's not big enough. But Betelgeuse at some point is going to blow up in a supernova. And when it does, it'll become the brightest thing in the sky after at night after the full moon. It'll be so bright you'll be able to see it during the day for a few weeks. But then it'll fade away and Orion won't have a left shoulder anymore.
Kaboom!
Yeah, and it could happen any time. It might not happen for a million years, but it could happen.
But it could happen tomorrow.
Yep.
Paul Kinzer, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at the stars with him today on the show. Brianne Chasseau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, sometimes brain injuries can change the essence of who we are. However, according to an author of the book, The Traumatized Brain, there are ways to unlock your brain's ability to repair itself. And we'll talk with that person at about 11:45 today. Right now, though, having some fun talking with Paul Kinzer, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Taking a look at the sky with him, you can join in with your own questions, comments, or observations. Love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you, and so please go ahead and call. And Paul's Stargazing Basics all got a whole new version of at least a, yeah.
That's right. This past summer, the second edition of Stargazing Basics came out, and the new edition has some colored images in it. The first one was all black and white. Updated information about the kinds of equipment that's out there and prices on it and what maybe you should choose and why. And
it's really quite a nice book. And Harvard Press, is it?
No, it's Cambridge University.
Cambridge University Press. Yeah.
So it's available everywhere if you're interested.
Yeah.
Including your library.
Yeah, including your library. And it's obviously Paul Kinzer, our guest today, is the author. And Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Bob in Eau Claire has a question. Bob, hi. Thanks for calling. Whoops. I don't know if we had a little we had a little issue there. We had all these calls on line, and then they all disappeared. So I don't know what happened. But maybe they'll come back, and we'll have them back again to ask the questions. I'm in the meantime, while we're getting those calls back up, What's this I hear about an upcoming total solar eclipse?
Yes. I've been waiting for this since I was five, and I'm 55 years old, so it'll be the first time since 1979 that a total solar eclipse has been over part of the continental U.S., and that one was just barely in Montana. And this one will cross the United States on August 21st, 2017. Yeah, it's a year and a half away, but start planning now because it's going to be amazing. It'll hit the Oregon coast, and it will quickly, very quickly, cross the nation and leave on the Atlantic coast. There will not be here in Madison or even in Wisconsin a total solar eclipse, but in Madison, I believe about 85% of the sun will be covered by the moon. The moon will pass in front of the sun. That's what a solar eclipse is. If you went the closest place to here where you could see totality would be southern Illinois.
Oh.
And for many people, it's a once-in-a-lifetime or a never-in-a-lifetime experience.
Sure.
I have never seen a total solar eclipse, and I am, I've already bought a book that's dedicated to the viewing of it, and I will be going where the weather says it's going to be clear on that day.
And, yeah.
When I was a child, I have a photograph of my brother, March 8th, 1970, holding a telescope. He's just a little kid, showing a partial solar eclipse on a piece of paper. And I remember a couple years later, the song You're So Vain came out by Carly Simon, where she has a line about, you went to Nova Scotia to see the total eclipse of the sun. Well, it was that one. And ever since then, I've been thinking, I need to see it. And I looked up as a child of maybe 10, when is the next one over the U.S.? Oh, man, 2017. But it's next year now, so I will be going to see it. And the weird thing is, then there will be another one crossing a large part of the United States in 2024.
Oh, so
we nothing and then two in a fairly short time.
Oh, man. Well, Walter in Verona has something for us, so let's go there. Walter, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Good morning, Larry and Paul. I have a question for you. I live out in the country, and I have pretty good ability to see the stars without a lot of light coming in around the area.
Yep.
And I've noticed in the evenings a series of satellites passing on a south to north trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask Paul, is there a way or a directory that I can go to figure out what it is I'm looking at? Because they come at the exact same time each night.
Well, I bet they don't come at the exact same time. Things in low Earth orbit, their orbits typically last about 90 minutes, so they're probably going to be off a little bit. And the reason you see them in the evening sky is because in the late at night you won't see them because the Earth is in the way. When you see a satellite, you're seeing its reflection of the sun. And, of course, hours after the sun sets, a couple of hundred miles up, you're still going to be able to see. The brighter one, the brightest one, is probably going to be the International Space Station. And the Hubble, you can also see, it's pretty bright. I do know there's a website called heavensabove.com, heavens-above.com, where you can load in your location. And I know they have some of the brighter satellites on a list there that you can get a little chart of over the next 10 days, when exactly will they pass over. So that's one way. I know there are other ones. I don't at my fingertips have the names of them, but there are ways. In fact, you can get software that you can download, often for free, where you can upload into that software the plots of many, many different satellites.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. I'm wondering what I'm looking at 10:15 at night, you know?
Yeah. If it's really bright, it's probably the International Space Station. And if you have a small telescope and you're good at pointing it, there are people who take images of it. One person, even with his telescope set up, he got a picture of it while there was an astronaut on a spacewalk. In his photograph, even though it was 200 and some miles up, whipping across the entire sky in 5 minutes, he got an image where you could, on one little pixel, there's the astronaut. You could see it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-800. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. And let's turn to Lynn in Pleasant Lake, Illinois. Hi, Lynn. Thank you for calling.
Well, actually, it's Pleasant Lake in Wisconsin near Coloma.
Oh.
But there's no light, what do you call it, degradation there?
We call it light pollution.
Yeah, light pollution. So, oh, my gosh, it's so gorgeous there. And the full moon, and my husband, after 40 years, he no longer asks, where are you going? Because I'm like, well, I have to go look at the full moon over the frozen lake and look at the way it comes through the pine trees, and I have to look at all the shadows. And, of course, Orion is very easy to see. And even at the lake, you can see the belt of Orion.
Oh, yeah.
Hanging down, and it is just so gorgeous. But my question is, sometimes I can see the Milky Way when I stand on our balcony, but sometimes I can't. So what is the best time to see the Milky Way, because we don't have that light pollution?
The best time in the evening sky to see the Milky Way is in the summer and into the fall.
Okay.
We don't see the center of the Milky Way very well here in the northern hemisphere. And the center of the Milky Way, our own galaxy, is the brightest part of it. If you want to see the center high in the sky, you'll need to go to South America. But here in Wisconsin, the center of the Milky Way is in the southern sky at 10 at night, 11 at night in July.
Okay.
But if you wait until September, it's up earlier, and the days aren't as long, so you don't have to wait. And you know, it doesn't really get dark till 11 at night in the summer. So, late summer, early fall—that's the best time.
Oh, thank you so much, because
sure.
I've seen it and I've been out there. And of course, we go to bed at like 8:30, 9 o'clock. So, I have to get up to go out there to see it because we're up by 5 in the morning. But that is great news. And,
well,
thank you so much.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Since you're saying that, though. I am not a morning person, so I don't, again, you might have to look this up, but if you're up early in the morning and you want to see the Milky Way, that would be at a different time of year, because it would, depending on where we are in our orbit, that's when you're going to see it. So you might want to, that's another thing, another good reason to have a thing, there's a little thing you can get made of plastic called a planisphere that shows you the night sky, and if you just look up planisphere, P-L-A-N-I-S, P-H-E-R-E, it'll show it to you. In fact, there's some you can download. Or you can download for free various apps like Stellarium. And it's a planetarium program. And then you can just, you put your location in there. You put the date and the time in there. And then you can make the night go by in half a minute. In fact, you can look at the sky 1,000 years from now or 1,000 years ago. And find out exactly what's up there and when.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thanks, Lynn, for calling. Appreciate it. Jerry in Phillips, Wisconsin, has something for us. Jerry, hi.
Yeah, the question, Larry and Paul, is how many satellites are there in space in totality? And how far up are they? What's the range, closest and furthest?
I know that the military tracks, I believe, 12,000 or so objects that are orbiting the Earth that we put up there. And they range in size from tools that astronauts dropped to large satellites like the Internet, well, or very, very large as a football field, the International Space Station. Most of those you can't see. Hundreds of them you can. The ones that move across the sky quickly, there's two main orbits and then some in between, what we call low Earth orbit and geostationary. The low Earth orbit satellites are a couple hundred miles to maybe 300 or 400 miles up.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones that you see crossing the sky. The geostationary ones, they stay above one point on the Earth. So those would be communication satellites, TV broadcast satellites, so that you can aim your dish network thing at one spot in the sky. And when you're doing that, you're aiming it at a satellite. Now, that satellite isn't staying still. As the Earth turns, it turns with the Earth. It's just at the exact right height that its orbit lasts 24 hours. low Earth orbit satellites, they typically, their orbits are about 90 minutes. So they're traveling at about 17,000 miles per hour.
Whoa. Yeah.
Yeah. They're moving along.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Yep. Thanks, Jerry, for calling. Mike in Wausau, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to just talk about real briefly about one of my favorite things is a website called spaceweather.com. And it's really cool because you can, not only does it have this elaborate library of northern lights, all kinds of information on satellites and, our solar system. And one of the things about it that I just love is they've got a wonderful app for the sky above. It's spaceweather.com is where you can get the app from, but it's really cool because I've gotten to the point where, like with the space station flying over, I can figure out, point up in the sky within a couple seconds to when it's going to show up in my visibility.
Yep.
And it's been a really cool thing and fun thing to do on Boy Scout campouts.
Yep.
It's just, the kids just, and adults too, they just love that.
Yeah, I have that spaceweather.com bookmarked. It's one of my probably top five astronomy websites. Another thing it has every single day is a photograph of an image of the sun, showing you what sunspot activity there is and what the chances of geomagnetic storms coming at us from the sun. And then that helps you know when possibly there would be northern lights.
Yeah.
The service, you can subscribe to it, and then it'll send you a text message if location that you subscribe from is, if there's northern lights visible there.
Right. Yeah, and this, what you said about knowing within a couple of seconds, a few years ago, I took my kids outside shortly after. I work with kids every day, and I took a group outside right after that chart became available on that other site I talked about, Heavens Above, and I took them out at about 5 p.m. in the winter, and I said, okay, everybody look right over there, and I pointed, and you're going to see something really cool. 3, 2, 1.
Yeah.
Boom, and there it was, and they looked at me like I was a magician. What's going on? So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Space. I pointed up at the sky, and we were like 200 scouts and leaders.
Oh, my. Yeah.
Standing there, and I just kept pointing up, and everybody's looking at me. Like, what is he doing? And pretty much we had all the people there looking up where I was pointing, and all of a sudden, bing, there was a space station flying.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Space Weather?
Spaceweather.com.
.com.
Yep.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Mike. I appreciate the call. And you could join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Do you have a question or comment or an experience to share? Love to hear from you. There's a dim star. Last year, a dim star made news when images of it showed up and getting brighter and dimmer over time in kind of unpredictable ways.
Yeah, this is one that's gotten some of the maybe questionable people out there talking, but a very dim star. Its real name is KIC 8462852. But I don't think people remember that. Some people call it Tabby's star, and that's for the lead scientist who study it. Her name is Tabitha Boyage, and I don't know if I'm saying her name right. But they noticed in images from the Kepler satellite, which was sent up there to find planets a few years ago. Kepler finds planets by looking at stars and imaging them, and then if their images over time dim, especially in periodic ways, they can then decide, oh, well, that's probably a planet passing in front of the star, making it get dimmer. But just the way things are, planets can never dim a star more than, I believe it's about 12 or 13%. Planets just can't get bigger than that. And this star was dimming by much larger amounts, and it wasn't doing it in a periodic way. So lots of people were wondering why, what could this possibly be? And we don't really have a good answer for why that would be. And so people started saying, it's aliens. It could be. Freeman Dyson, a very famous astronomer years ago, he said maybe a very advanced society would put very, very, very large solar panels out from their star to get the star's energy. So people have said, well, maybe this is one of those. They're building these huge things. Of course, we don't have any evidence for that, so it's total speculation. But then another scientist looked at, there was a survey that ran that would take pictures of the same chunk of sky from 1890 all the way to 1989, and that star was in there. He looked at it and found that over that 100-year period, that star had dimmed by an appreciable amount, like 20-30%, I can't remember. There's no known scientific reason for that to happen. And it didn't happen in a linear way. It dimmed, and then it got brighter, and then it dimmed again. So this is a mystery star. We don't know, but people are going to be keeping an eye on that star and trying to figure out what is going on.
How would we be ever able to get a decent shot of it?
After this happened, enough people thought, well, it could be aliens, that they aimed a radio telescope at it and listened to see if maybe it was having its own version of I Love Lucy or something. And, of course, they didn't hear anything, and the odds of us hearing anything would be tiny because it would take quite a powerful radio signal. Probably it would need to be directly aimed at us on purpose for us to pick that up. But they'll just keep aiming telescopes at it on a regular basis. It can be seen. I don't know how bright it is or even how far away it is, but it's not like some major star that's bright that you can just look up at and point at. But it is easily imaged by professional telescopes, so they'll keep their eyes on that.
Lynn in Eau Claire has something for us. Hi, Lynn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Brilliant show as usual. And this is just a little, it's very light. My son lives in California. He lives in Merced. And during a solar eclipse, he's a real avid sky watcher. He went into the local hardware store to see about renting a welder's mask to watch the eclipse. And oh, no, we don't do that. So he found out the return policy, bought one, watched the eclipse. And then I asked him if there was anything he would have done. He said differently. Yes, he would have, you know, bought a lawn chair, too.
Yeah, yes.
But that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
the light side.
But a welder's mask, you can look at the sun?
If you're careful to know, and you can find this out. Again, I don't have the number. They come in different depths of darkness. I think it's number 15, but don't hold me to that. You can also just buy a sheet of welder's glass, a replacement sheet for a mask, so you don't need the whole mask, and just a little, like, it's like a 3 by 4 inch piece of welder's glass, and look up. There are other kinds of solar filters that you can get that you can put on binoculars or telescopes. Of course, you got to be really, really careful to never look directly at the sun, especially through something that's going to magnify the view, like binoculars or telescopes. You shouldn't do that without a solar filter, but there are very good solar filters on the market, and in the next year, you are really going to start hearing about them, because will be a huge event.
Marketing opportunity for somebody.
Yeah, there are already hotels along the route that are booked solid.
Wow.
Yeah, there are places out there where if you call even now and say, I'd like a room on August 20th of 2017, sorry, we're full. So there are people planning right now to see this.
Year and a half out.
Yeah.
And then what if it's you pick a place where it's cloudy?
Well, and you can go online and find climate information for where is the track of the eclipse and where is the most likely spot for clear skies. And I'm not telling you where that is because I'm going to be there. No. Out the further west you go in general, the more
better.
Likely it's going to be clear, especially on the eastern slopes of maybe not right on the mountain, but east of mountain ranges. That's where you're going to have the clearest weather.
Jerry in West Allis, up next. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. I guess I'm afraid I'm going to be repeating the previous caller. That's what I was called in to say the last time. I do weld in my job. I do welding, and so the last time there was one, I recall, I think it was in the late 70s, and I grabbed my arc welding mask. Typically, it's a number 10 shade is what they start people out at, and I found over the years that I'm more comfortable with the number 12 shade. And just to be on the safe side, because I didn't know that it was permissible, I'd always heard as a kid, you know, don't look at it. So I had on my number 12 shade welder's mask and my number 5 shade torch goggles underneath. And then when that was too dark, I slowly worked to just an ordinary pair of sunglasses behind the welder's mask, just to be on the safe side. But I never experienced any adverse effects. I was very careful, and I didn't look at it, you know, too long, but it seemed to work out just fine, and if anybody's interested in that, usually a number 12 or so should be just fine.
Yeah, and I would look it up and find out what astronomers think the safe level of a welder's mask. And again, there are frankly better solar filters that are made for astronomical purposes. People, your eyes zip by the sun as you're moving around. It's not going to destroy your vision right away. The biggest danger of looking at the sun typically is if you're doing it through binoculars or a telescope. You absolutely do not want to do that without a safe solar filter. And by safe, never, ever, some telescopes are sold with filters that you screw onto the eyepiece, a little thing that screws on. Never, ever use those. They shouldn't even be legal to sell.
Oh.
The sun shining through your telescope and hitting that, it's like, you know, people burning ants with a magnifying glass.
Oh.
Those little filters can crack. The only safe solar filter is one that goes on the outside end of the telescope before light enters the telescope.
Yeah. Where would they be available?
And you go online and solar filter, telescope, solar filter. They're sold in many, many, many places.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. All right, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. By the way, Paul, how's the book? Is the book selling?
My editor just wrote to me and said that it's selling as well as they expect. You know, it's a pretty niche market for it, but it's doing okay.
Well, and that's great to hear. And what about, I wanted to mention your little side thing that you do, which I think is really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I run a business called Seeing Stars Portable Planetarium, and I travel around mostly Wisconsin with my portable planetarium. It can fold up into a big duffel bag, and I use it in gyms and libraries to share the night sky during the day.
And it sounds like a lot of fun, and a lot of times with schools and libraries and so forth.
Schools and libraries mostly, and if you just look up my name, Paul Kinzer, Seeing Stars, you'll find my website.
And Paul Kinzer, Seeing Stars, and there it is. And I think we're, I was just trying to remember if we've said everything we needed to say here, and I think we're pretty well covered it. It's always fun to get into the night sky, isn't it?
It sure is.
Yeah. Thanks again, Paul.
Sure. Thank you.
Paul Kinzer, author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy, member of the La Crosse Area Astronomy Club, and it's great to have him come by and talk about what's up there in the stars. And if you're a morning person like me and you get out in the morning, don't forget Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, Mercury, they're all in that morning sky. And so if you're up at 5:30, we'll be looking at those planets together.
Well, and if we have a minute, there is one more thing. There is actually a comet in the evening sky.
Oh, I forgot about
that you can see right now. It's called Comet Catalina. Its official name is C/2013 US 10. We don't need to explain what that means because I don't really get it. But it was discovered by an astronomy survey called the Catalina telescope. It found the comet, and comets are named after whatever finds them, and now there are computer-operated telescopes finding them. And it's right between the Big and the Little Dippers, and you can go online, look up Comet Catalina Star Chart, and you'll be able to see right where
exactly
to see it.
Exactly where it is.
Now, you probably won't be able to see it very well from a city, but if you're out a ways from town, look up in that part of the sky with a pair of binoculars, and you'll just probably with your naked eye you can see it, but with binoculars it'll be a little greenish fuzzball. And that's a neat thing about comets. They're one of the few astronomy related items that are green, and that's gas basically melting off them as they get closer to the sun, and I believe it's oxygen that shows that greenish color. And this is a special comet. It's just come in. Many comets come in and they return after, you know, like Halley's Comet comes in every 76 years, but some, they only come every 1,000 or 10,000. Well, this one, they figure from its orbit, has never been here before. It's its first time coming in from what's called the Oort cloud. And that is much farther away even than that Planet 9 we were talking about. And this is its first visit in, and I believe it has now, I think it's already zipped around the sun. It's on its way out again, and it will never come back. So,
and I think about Hale-Bopp.
Oh, yes.
Comet Hale-Bopp was, you could almost like pluck it out of the sky. It was so bright.
Yes, and it was huge. Comets can
enormous.
Be, comets can be pretty much any size, and if it's a very, it's basically one word used for, or phrase used for it is a dirty snowball. It's mostly ice and ice of water, but other frozen gases too, with some rock and dirt in it. And as it gets nearer the sun heats it up. That gas starts to sublimate and enter the space around it. The comets that we see with our naked eye, what we're looking at is millions of miles away, and it's mostly what we're seeing is that gas. We never really see the solid body in the middle. That solid body might be a mile across, maybe 5 miles, maybe less than a mile, but the coma, the cloud of gas around it, might be over a million miles across, bigger than the sun.
Well,
and it's really traveling quickly too.
And I will never forget that experience. That one won't come. We won't get.
Well,
that.
You know, people say about once a generation we get a very bright comet. We can't predict them. You know, the year before that there was one called Comet Hyakutake, and if Hale-Bopp had never come, that would be the one people remember. The special thing about that, it wasn't anything like as bright as Hale-Bopp, but it had a tail on it that stretched halfway across the sky. And so that's the other thing. Every comet is different. It's different in, you know, what does its tail look like? There was one last year that had a tail that looked like a fan. It was just very, very wide. Everyone is different. And every time I hear, oh, here comes a new one, and we don't know what they're going to look like, I'm like, ooh, another Hale-Bopp, please. That would be nice.
Another Hale-Bopp, please.
That would be nice.
On that note, we'll close. Paul, thanks again.
Thank you.
Paul Kinzer, he'll be back. We'll do it again with him. He's the author of Stargazing Basics, Getting Started in Recreational Astronomy. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about unlocking the brain's ability to repair itself after injury. Some really cool stuff in a nice book. And we'll have the author with us next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.